You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. During this week's game of Monday Night Football, Buffalo Bills safety DeMar Hamlin made a seemingly routine tackle of Cincinnati Bengals wide receiver T. Higgins. The hit, though, caused Hamlin to go into cardiac arrest. Team doctors performed CPR on the field for 9 minutes before he was rushed to the hospital. Earlier this afternoon, as Dr. Timothy Pritz provided a positive update on Hamlin's condition, saying he's awake and responsive, but still using a breathing tube.
When he asked, did we win? The answer is yes. You know, DeMar, you won. You've won the game of life. And that's probably the most important thing out of this. And we really need to keep him at the center of everything else that's going on.
The emotional reaction to the injury led to the entire game being suspended without finishing, at least for now. The responses echoed throughout the NFL and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you watching the game when this happened? What was your reaction? If you don't watch football or sports, how did you hear about the situation? Does this all change the way you think of football as a sport? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jason Gay is a sports columnist for the Wall Street Journal. He recently published a book of essays called I Wouldn't Do That If I Were Me. His latest column is headlined Football Can Wait for DeMar Hamlin. Jason, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
What was your reaction when you saw what was happening to DeMar Hamlin?
I mean, I was horrified. I think that was the general reaction to it. If you watch the game of football, which I do, both as somebody who enjoys it as entertainment, but also writes about it, you are kind of accustomed to injuries. You're accustomed sometimes to severe life-altering injuries. However, you're not, accustomed to the scene that we saw on Monday night where you had players summoning, emergency medical staff to come right onto the field, an ambulance coming right onto the field, CPR being performed on this athlete. Really a touch and go, terrifying situation. And, again, for a sport that has this kind of bravado around the idea of injury and playing through it, it was stunning.
And we heard Dr. Pritz there saying we need to keep DeMar Hamlin at the center of everything else that's going on. That's really a big theme in your column. For now, it's not about the sport, the team, or the game. It's about him.
Oh, I agree with the doctor, and I think they've done an excellent job of kind of, maintaining that focus upon, obviously, his condition. And his condition is, though things are optimistic, they're obviously proceeding with a great deal of caution and guardedness about disclosing, outcomes and so on. But absolutely. I mean, DeMar Hamlin was somebody who wasn't necessarily a household name going into this game. He was a player who had gotten a break to play in the secondary of the Buffalo Bills this season due to other player injuries, was making an impact there, was very well liked among his teammates, but kind of represents the rank and file of the NFL, people who are coming. He was a 6th-round draft choice. He's not making zillions of dollars. Not a great deal was known about him before this. Now I feel like people are much more in touch with his background, his career, his upbringing. This is a Pittsburgh guy who played at the University of Pittsburgh. Family guy, was very oriented to making sure that he served as a role model. He got a very young younger brother, and had been charitably minded. You may have seen one of the things that's come out of this, which, you would never want to say there's a silver lining to anything like this. You just don't want it to ever happen at all. But he had a charitable organization that was doing a toy drive in his native Pittsburgh, I believe, that was, had thousands of dollars in donations, before this incident. And now I believe it's somewhere close to $8 million. And I think that's a byproduct of people watching this and feeling helpless, feeling that there was almost nothing they could do. And this was a way of, honoring this guy's legacy and impact.
There were questions about what was going to happen on Monday night for a while. It seemed like they were going to maybe continue playing the game. What do you think of how that was all handled in the moment?
Well, to be candid, I never thought they were going to resume the game. It just seemed very clear from the body language of the players on the sideline and the coaches that there was just no way that these players were going to be able to summon the energy to go back out there and play. The sort of extended time it took to make that official, I don't know exactly what was happening on behind the scenes in terms of, what parties had to check off on what was happening, But again, this is like, you know, part of the ritual of football is that we see these extreme things happen sometimes. And again, you know, sometimes very severe injuries, spinal cord injuries, concussions, and so on. And the games do resume. So there's kind of this customary expectation that they were going to get back there and play. And of course, if you're watching this at home, you're horrified. You're like, of course you can't play. You have to get out of here and like let people get to the hospital and, you know, respect this guy's situation. But I think that was just sort of a case of football sort of being football. And, you know, I think in the short and long term, the correct decision was made to postpone and suspend the game.
Green Bay Packers head coach Matt LaFleur was among the many coaches in the league who offered support for Hamlin and reflected some on the situation.
It kind of puts, you know, what we do into perspective and how that supersedes anything in life is just these players' health and safety and everybody's health and safety.
And all of this makes me think, you know, as a sports fan myself, you know, you look at football players and their competitors and teammates. Well, they're also friends and coworkers. And, you know, that could have been me kind of situation for a lot of people. It really highlights the humanity of these people we watch on the screen every week.
Oh, I think so. Absolutely. And I think that you're exactly right when you say that they look at him and they say that, you know, could have been them. This was an injury that there wasn't especially anything that was particular about it or particular to the kind of, you know, tackle it was or the position that was played. It was a very, very flukish thing. In fact, this is an injury, you know, if it turns out to be what has been suspected the injury is, which is this condition called commotio cardiac, where the heartbeat is interrupted at such a point that it puts a player in cardiac distress. That's something that happens in other sports, and it is very flukish. And I think that the reaction that you saw on the field was very human and natural, and I agree entirely that it's based upon this idea of, A, this is a brother of theirs, this is somebody who's a teammate who they share time with and common goals, but also that it could really be anybody. Okay. And I think that, honestly, the national reaction to it, too, that sort of feeling of helplessness. I mean, football is not a sport that, you know, strictly happens on Monday nights in professional arenas. It happens in every kind of, you know, hamlet and community in America. And these kinds of things are always back of mind for parents and athletes and coaches.
Talking to Jason Gay, sports columnist of the Wall Street Journal, looking at the cardiac arrest suffered by Buffalo Bills player Damar Hamlin on Monday Night Football this week. The reaction, you can share your reaction at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jason, on a wider note, the NFL, I think, in particular among sports, it seems like it goes on in many cases no matter what. It takes something really huge to make it stop happening. I remember, with other sports, like COVID stopped the Premier League in England. That seemed like a big deal. It stopped basketball. I don't know. Like, do we count on the NFL too much to go through anything, any weather, any such situation, and keep going?
Well, it is one of those sports, right? We're accustomed to, you know, people in Wisconsin know what it's like to look out in Lambeau Field and see snow pouring down and the game still going on. This is not something that is not a sport that, you know, just stops for ordinary things. We've seen situations where major weather events are coming into communities and they actually pick up and they move the game to somewhere else, a region where the game can continue. So there is this kind of, like, you know, by any means necessary approach to that. So I do feel like that contributed to maybe some of the initial sort of, you know, I don't want to say outrage, but just sort of like people's agitation Monday night when they sensed that there was some sort of delay and suspected that there was an effort to put the players back out onto the field. But it doesn't seem to be the case that, you know, players were told to get back out there and play.
And then as sports fans, as you said, we know injuries are a possibility. We've heard concerns about concussions for NFL and football at other levels. I don't know, how do we as fans reconcile knowing that players are at some risk here in part for our entertainment?
Well, that reconciliation is not, you know, specific to what happened on Monday night. Mm-hmm. I think anybody who watches professional or high level football or even, you know, youth football is making some, you know, emotional and cognitive disconnect from the real life risks that exist around a sport that is played at high speed and contact and often violent contact. You know, if you ever have the opportunity to be down on the sideline of, you know, a major college or a professional football game, you would be stunned at what looks to be rather minor contact on television, you know, players colliding at the line of scrimmage, tackles of running backs and so on. They almost seem like automobile crashes. You're just shocked at the, you know, velocity and contact and the noise and the grunting of it. There's an awful lot of sort of compartmentalization that happens around football. I mean, keep in mind that despite everything, despite this history, despite the, you know, the settlements that have happened around the issue of CTE and long-term brain injuries, football is by far not just the most popular sport in America, it is the most popular entertainment product, period. It is the thing that stirs the drink in terms of what people watch on television is really sort of the last part of American monoculture that we sort of all sit and watch together. And I think that's a huge reason why Monday night, you know, proved to be this rather seismic thing, because it's really one of the last things we all kind of watch collectively.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Bruce is with us in Green Bay. Bruce, hi.
Hi, how are you? I wanted to just comment that I watched the game live, saw this young man collapse, and because of the experience that my wife and I had had, we knew right away he had cardiac arrest, because my wife several years ago suffered ventricular fibrillation from a different cause. But, you know, her family and I were the ones that were the players. We're on the scene. Frankly, you know, I did the CPR. The guys got there in time. They sedated her. They cooled her down. And we had a happy result. So we were praying that the young man would have the same result, and it sounds like he did. I guess my comment is that, you know, when they were talking about him being sedated and they're talking about it being cooled down, that, you know, that this was sort of presented as being this dire, awful thing, and that's the treatment. I mean, that's what you do. And it's kind of a long shot thing, but that is the treatment. And I thought there was a bit of an overreaction, and I think there was a little overreaction to the whole thing with the NFL saying you're going to play again in 5 minutes, which isn't what they said. They said we're taking a five-minute break because one of the sports commentators made the point today, it takes time to contact the public authorities to reverse the traffic directions, to do these things. So I think, you know, there aren't very many naysayers up there for the league, but I think the league acted appropriately and with concern, and you know, and God bless, especially, you know, the head coaches. So,
Bruce, thanks a lot for the call. Sorry about the scary story. Glad it had a happy ending for your wife. Jason, Bruce, a lot of thoughts there. What do you think?
Well, first of all, I mean, I share with you, you know, my salutations to Bruce and to his wife, and I'm very glad that that had a, you know, happy ending and you know, incredible work with that quick reaction. He makes an important point here, which is that there were, you know, real acts of heroism that night. You know, I know what he's saying, that these things are routine. However, you know, we know from all kinds of incidents that, you know, the routine medical reactions to things sometimes can't be counted upon. It's required a number of people on the field. The doctors actually talked about this today, to behave quickly, diligently, you know, professionally, expertly, to revive and bring this guy back. And he's absolutely right that the sort of protocol that has happened here is very customary for cardiac events like this. However, I don't think it diminishes how frightening it was right for the people who are on field or people who are watching it at home.
Thanks a lot, Bruce, for sharing your perspective. We're talking to Wall Street Journal sports columnist Jason Gay about the injury and cardiac arrest suffered by Buffalo Bills football player DeMar Hamlin, the response from the sports world and beyond. Jason wrote about this in his column at the Journal. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Want to hear from you. What was your reaction? Are you a football fan? Were you watching as this happened? What went through your mind as this was going on? What do you think of the reaction from the NFL world? Call in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up the conversation with Jason Gay, sports columnist for The Wall Street Journal, with us today to talk about the impact of Buffalo Bills football player DeMar Hamlin entering cardiac arrest after hit on the field in a Monday night game. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your reactions. If you were watching the game in particular, but if not, you can still join in, 800-642-1234. Vivian joins us now in Green Bay. Vivian, hi.
Hello. I really applaud all the people who are supporting Hamlin's charity. But if this young man is permanently injured, who's going to cover all his medical costs? Maybe there should be a GoFundMe for his finances.
Vivian, thanks for the call. This has been a concern out there, Jason, that I had wanted to bring up. Thank you, Vivian, that only a couple years into a career, you are not necessarily guaranteed medical coverage, as I understand, in the future by the NFL.
Right. He is not a vested member of the NFL pension as of yet. And I think that this will definitely provoke some reconsideration of this. As you know, like, all this is, you know, part of the collective bargaining process. And I am sure it will be an issue that is revisited by the NFLPA, because what you're 100% right to point out that this is a very young man in the early parts of life. The fact that he is early in a career should not somehow be at a disadvantage if he suffers such a significant life event like this.
Thanks a lot for the call, Vivian, at 800-642-1234. Lisa joins us now in Burlington. Lisa, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to kind of say that as someone that really isn't all, but I did follow what happened, and I'm an ER nurse, that I echo what your last caller said. These things that went on were actually completely protocol, and I think that they did a great job, and that it's very normal to be able to kind of criticize it after the fact, but you never know how things are going to go in that moment.
Lisa, thanks for the call, and thanks for the work you do as an ER nurse. One thing, maybe you can help me out. Like, if I just saw somebody collapse after a hit like that, is this a concussion? Is this, I don't know what, like, how do we identify that this was a cardiac event and start that treatment right away?
Right. Well, it appeared that that's what they did, although I didn't analyze it greatly. But, yes, that's exactly what happens. You approach them, you assess their level of consciousness, you check their pulse. You find that they don't have a pulse, and you begin CPR. The young man is probably doing as well as he is because it was a witnessed arrest. And when it's a witnessed arrest, they have a very best chance of having a good outcome. But like your last caller said, or somebody said, you know, it probably was very difficult to, you know, get the network and everything, like, you know, all figured out. You know, people just want drama. They want to, you know, make drama about everything. And it's like, oh, they didn't do it right. You know, I think they probably just did the best they could in a really tough situation.
Lisa, thanks a lot for the call. Jason, I don't think I've heard that much criticism of the direct medical treatment here, more of just, you know, the decision, how soon the decision was made to postpone the game at that point.
Yeah, I have not heard that either. I would also add to the fact, and I'm curious if she's still on the line, about just the, you know, making sure that not just for a high-level professional sporting event such as this, but in other sporting events, to have access and quick access to defibrillation, because that is obviously something that also contributed to his restoration of his heartbeat.
She has left the ER, but that's something I was wondering, too, if this was not a high-profile NFL game, but a Division III college game or a high school game or something like that, would we have that kind of medical response ready?
Yeah, I mean, depending on what the school is and the conferences are, I mean, you find even at the youth sports level that there is increased prioritization of this, because, again, this is not an injury that is exclusive to football. It can really happen in almost any sort of contact sport or something where something at high velocity can hit you in the chest, assuming that that's, in fact, what happened here. So I do feel that, like, people are becoming more alert to this, but this could be kind of, we've talked about this a little bit at work, you know, does this kind of go down as a moment in which, you know, people involved in sports, whether it's youth sports, school sports, professional sports, just, you know, really dial up and make sure that they have access to this kind of thing, because obviously you saw its incredible utility the other night.
Thanks again for that call. Bill joins us now in Sun Prairie. Bill, hi.
Hi. Yes, I wanted to comment on a couple of things. One of them is, I've been a football fan since the 1950s. And nobody has mentioned the fact that we've gone through this with a Detroit Lions player in the late 70s, early 80s that wound up being a quadriplegic. The other thing of it is that bothers me a lot is the NFL has really promoted the dramatic tackles, the throwing the body into one another, that sort of thing, instead of good, solid, basic football tackles that you're taught from the time you start playing football. And that concerns me that the NFL is actually, I think, promoting that kind of activity on the football field.
Bill, I gotcha. In our last minute or so, Jason, can pro football be made safer?
I don't know if it can be made like literally safer. I think that they have been prioritizing safer tackling techniques, and I would just counter that. I understand what the gentleman is saying about, you know, promotion of violent hits and so on, but you see a lot less of that mm-hmm. than you may have a generation ago when they used to sell like VHS cassettes of like the NFL's hardest hits. And so there's really been a strong effort to try to take out the savagery from that game. It doesn't mean that those kinds of things don't happen. In fact, you do see them happen on a regular basis. But you do see players, you know, thrown out of games for them. You do see the helmet-to-helmet type of tackling that has really been prohibited. I don't know if it necessarily adds up to a safer sport because athletes are getting faster, just better, and these collisions are happening with extreme force. So it's an awfully hard ask. And it's just the nature of football. It's a contact-based, often violent sport.
Thanks to our guest today, Jason Gay, sports columnist of the Wall Street Journal, talking about his latest column called Football Can Wait for Damar Hamlin. Tomorrow on Central Time, we're surrounded by easy access to quit hits of pleasure. We'll talk to the author of the book Dopamine Nation tomorrow on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll get the latest on the effort to elect a speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives and look ahead at the big issues facing a divided Congress. First, the U.S. and China are tied together by international trade. China is the top source of imports to the United States, and it's the third biggest market for products from the United States, behind Canada and Mexico, and for products from Wisconsin. In American politics, there have been concerns about a trade deficit with China, and more recently, international political rivalry has raised security fears about dependence on China, from machinery to computer chips to social media. But untangling those business connections could be way easier said than done. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the U.S. Economic connections with China? Do you buy or avoid materials marked with that Made in China label? Does that matter to you at all? What questions do you have about the economic connections between the often political rivals? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And if your business relies on selling stuff to China or buying stuff from China, love to hear from you as well. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Zoe Liu is Fellow for International Political Economy at the Council on Foreign Relations. Zoe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob. Thank you very much for having me.
I spelled out some of the basics there. Can you talk a little bit more about how interconnected the American economy is with the Chinese economy?
Yes, absolutely. And I think you've already gave us a very good and a very solid overview in terms of the trade relationship between the two countries, right? And indeed, exactly as you said, despite the trade war since the Trump administration's especially escalating starting from 2018, China and the U.S. trade is still very much tied together. And by 2021, China was the largest trading partner of the United States, and by a lot of measures, trading with China actually have created more than 2 million jobs on a yearly basis. And then on top of that, if we think about people-to-people exchanges, prior to the pandemic, every year China had been sending a lot of Chinese students to study in America. And Wisconsin is actually one of the top destinations for Chinese students to study in America.
This has been controversial, though, since we went from zero trade to China, more or less, in the early 1970s to opening of trade ties. Can you talk about the benefits we've seen in the U.S., especially in terms of cheaper stuff, and the costs, especially in terms of losing factories in some cases?
Yes, absolutely. So in terms of the benefit, right, trading with China, there are the goods, the bads, and the ugly. So let's start with the goods. I think from a consumer's perspective, the most significant benefit would be cheaper imported goods from China, from toys to TVs or computers or cell phones assembled in China. And then secondly, trading with China also created a lot of jobs in America, specifically from the perspective of not necessarily lost manufacturing jobs, but jobs in the service industry as well. And then thirdly, by trading with China, the added benefit is that the liberal, especially from the liberal political perspective, by influencing Chinese middle class, by interacting with Chinese consumers, we are hoping that America's way of life, America's ideas might influence the Chinese people, and then change China from a relatively authoritarian regime to a more open political system. And then on the more controversial aspect of it, especially on the trade part, we have roughly speaking five primary areas of a concern. The top of which, especially we read in the headlines these days, would be national security. And that's to start with, you know, our cell phones or social media platforms being influenced by Chinese government or controlled by Chinese government or subject to espionage and things like that. So that's national security. And then secondly, there is also the concerns about the China's unfair trade behavior or unfair trade practices that might have hurt American businesses and American interests. And then thirdly, there is the concern of job losses. The idea is China has comparative advantage in terms of producing relatively low cost goods, and that might replace a lot of manufacturing jobs here in the United States. And then fourthly, the concern would be related to environmental concerns from the perspective of the use of relatively poisonous materials or the damage to environment. And the last but not least, there is also the concern with regard to labor rights. And a lot of these have been played out, especially in the context of Xinjiang Uyghurs and the treatment of prison laborers.
I want to get to one of those things you mentioned as a possible upside, the idea that increased trade, increased market economy was going to make the Chinese government hopefully less authoritarian. I think there's concern that with the current administration regime there, that's not happening, that Chinese authoritarian leaders have figured out how to make that not happen.
You know, Rob, I think you nailed it just now. And the idea of, you know, economic interdependence would prevent countries to go to war, and year after year we might be able to convert the other countries more like us. That's a kind of very genuine and very very missionary idea of America, of us here, right? And in many ways, I would say China has changed, and the Chinese consumers have been looking up to America and American way of life, you know, just by looking at the numbers of Chinese students who came to study in America and want to stay here, right? So I think that's a very positive sign. But then on the other hand, from the leader's perspective, if the population inside or the citizens of a country started to have different ideas than what you tend to want them to have, that may not necessarily be a comforting sign. So I would say right now, what is facing American policymakers right now is not necessarily the Chinese consumers or the Chinese citizen or, for that matter, Chinese middle class, but really is the leadership, the Communist Party's leadership.
Talking to Zoe Liu, a fellow for international political economy at the Council on Foreign Relations, looking at the U.S. dependency on production and trade in China. A lot of political concerns, security concerns, but a lot of interconnectedness between the economies of the two nations. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have U.S.-China trade relations impacted your life, your income at all over the years? Would you like to see the U.S. move away from producing things in China, buying things from China? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue this conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Zoe Liu, a fellow for international political economy at the Council on Foreign Relations, looking at the future of U.S.-China trade relations. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts, what you've seen maybe in your own career, your own business. Do you rely on selling stuff, agricultural products, say, to China? Call 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Alan is with us in Kenosha. Alan, hi.
Hey, and thank you for having me on. You know, it's all, when you're dealing with China, it's all about your name. And you need to know where your name is and where you live. And I think we really need to recognize that people in Shanghai, Taiwan, that these are our current economic friends within the larger administration. The holdover, nobody wants to be part of the CCP elite, and I think that's where a lot of this is going. Gotcha. For right now.
Alan, thanks a lot for the call. He mentioned Shanghai, Taiwan, of course, a separate country, unless, of course, you ask the leaders of mainland China. But Alan, making a point that I think you were getting at, Zoe, that we might be trading with elements, with business groups in China, and that's not the same thing, Alan says, as supporting the Chinese Communist Party, the current regime in China.
I think what Alan made a great point there, recognizing that actually China is a very heterogeneous country, and where you live actually determines your interest. So from that perspective, it's very much similar to here in the United States. Like, for example, if China wanted to open up and practice free trade, a lot of these major cities on the ocean area is going to be very happy. For example, like Shenzhen, Guangzhou, Shanghai benefited tremendously from trading with the United States, but less so for the inland area. So I think Alan made a great point there.
Thanks for the call, Alan. Gary joins us now in Ripon. Gary, hi.
Hello. I think there's a certain falseness even in referring to this as trade, since the great, great preponderance of the money is going all one way and not so much the other. I mean, we're funding communist China to a much tremendously greater degree than they fund us.
Gary, thanks for the call. And Zoe, Gary hitting on a concern from many in the U.S. that the trade, there's a gap, a deficit, more money flowing out to China than into the United States.
You know, Gary, that is a very interesting observation you made there. And I have to say, yes, you actually touched upon the issue of what we would say, you know, economists would refer to that as a trade deficit. The idea is we are buying more Chinese goods than the Chinese are buying from us. But the other side of the trade deficit is the so-called foreign exchange reserves that have been accumulated by the Chinese central bank. And because of the nature of the Chinese system and the relatively lack of sophisticated financial market, China, or for that matter, the Chinese People's Bank of China, the central bank, it had limited options, but had to invest in U.S. treasuries. In other words, actually right now, what we are seeing is China has been the largest foreign exchange, China has been the largest U.S. treasury holders for quite quite some time. So from that matter, we are, you know, by running a larger trade deficit with China, we are also sort of hijacking China to invest in U.S. treasuries.
Thanks for the call, Gary. Mike joins us now in the Fox River Valley. Mike, hello.
Hi. Wisconsin had a thriving paper and printing industry that up until sometime in the mid-90s, all the printing that I see now of publications, magazines, some of the large books are all printed in China. And it breaks my heart because cities like Wisconsin Rapids and Wausau and Appleton, there was a lot of lost jobs in the paper industry, and those were very high-paying, well jobs in the printing industry. Was also something that surrounding states like Iowa, Michigan, Minnesota, Illinois didn't lose as much as Wisconsin did.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. And Mike hits on, I think, a big concern that in certain communities and certain industries, we had a very concentrated negative impact from opening up trade with China, including printing here in Wisconsin, Zoe.
Yes, absolutely. And Mike's point with regard to printing and paper industry, I think that's a good example. Another good example that might have suffered from, especially from the trade war with China, is the ginseng growing industry in Wisconsin. I grew up in China, and a lot of my relatives there are major consumers of Wisconsin ginseng. And but after trade war, they recognized that in order to buy ginseng tea made from Wisconsin, the price increased by more than a half. So from that perspective, the trade war with China is hurting our communities in Wisconsin, but it's also hurting the Chinese consumers.
Thanks for that call. So I want to take our last couple of minutes to look at the alternatives. If the American political system decides, yes, we want to extricate ourselves from this much trade with China, what could that look like? What kind of options would be on the table to say we're going to buy fewer microchips and printed goods, and the list goes on and on from China?
Oh yeah, that's a great mental exercise. But I would have to take a step back and say, if we were leaving a complete, if we were heading towards a complete trade decoupling with China, we are going to see, you know, whenever we go to the grocery store, we are going to have to pay a lot more for our whatever we are buying now. And then on top of that, we probably will couple that with inflationary pressure, where probably a lot of our middle class people here in the United States are going to suffer, not because of our diminished relationship with China, but also simply from the price pressure perspective. And then on the other hand, I do not think fully decoupling with China is going to be easily achieved. And if we just take the supply chain divorce these days, you know, dominant newsline headline, for example, I would argue that a complete supply chain divorce from China would be extremely difficult, and it would not happen overnight. Take, you know, the iPhone, for example. Like right now, about 98% of iPhones have been assembled in China, and that is the result of more than two decades of effort that Apple has been putting in their building supply chains in China. And if Apple were to remove their productions to China, it's probably going to take them about by 2030, Apple would at most move 10% of their production capacity out of China. So from that perspective, I do not think decoupling is going to happen anytime soon.
Zoe, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob, and thank you for our audience.
That was Zoe Liu, a fellow for international political economy at the Council on Foreign Relations. She joined us today to talk about the future of U.S.-China trade relations. Wisconsin's population is aging. State estimates show that almost a quarter of residents will be 65 or older by 2040. Helping people stay mobile as they age is critical to help them maintain their quality of life and independence. But local public transit agencies and nonprofits are already struggling to do that. Jonah Chester reports.
It's a warm October day in Green Bay, and Kathy Koch has a dentist appointment to get to.
All right.
Hold it right there, and I'll come on the other side.
Okay, sounds good.
Koch is 79 and has lived in the same home for more than half a century. She relies on a walker to get around, and she can't drive herself to the office.
My husband's been dead for a while, so to ask the children, it's difficult. They all work. The grandchildren all work.
Koch relies on an organization called Curative Connections. The Green Bay nonprofit provides services, including transportation, to the elderly and people with disabilities. As the driver helps her out of the van, she says Curative is also a connection to her community.
Oh, I love the human contact.
Yeah, it's very important.
It doesn't happen very often. I'm going to let you get the belt.
People over 65 are becoming a larger and larger portion of Wisconsin's population. That means more people will rely on specialized transportation to stay mobile. But without more support, Wisconsin's paratransit systems may not be ready to support the state's aging population. Like other states, Wisconsin received transportation funding through federal infrastructure and COVID aid bills. Green Bay Metro Transit Director Patty Kiewiz says that money was helpful, but wasn't a permanent fix.
So I think the next few years here will be, you know, in a much better position than we have been. But, you know, that's also something you need to be careful of, is that's really kind of one-time money. Then what are we going to do in a couple, you know, in 3 years?
That's a multi-million dollar question. The largest source of state funding to improve transit for the elderly and disabled hasn't risen in years. And other state transit spending fell to its lowest level in more than a decade last year. Green Bay Metro has coped with declining funds by cutting and consolidating bus routes and paratransit services. They're trying to fill the gaps with a local ride-hailing app. Organizations like Curative Connections are trying to patch the remaining cracks in the system, but they're also facing the economic challenges of inflation and higher gas prices. Curative's transportation director, Tina Wietung, says they've also lost about half of their volunteer drivers since the beginning of the pandemic, and they can't afford to replace all of them with paid drivers.
We've had to limit the number of rides based on volunteer and driver availability, so we're down probably 30% compared to prior years before COVID.
Advocates say on-demand services like Curative are important, but still imperfect. Tamara Jackson co-chairs the Non-Driver Advisory Committee for the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. She says many paratransit resources are concentrated in urban areas.
Public transit often ends at jurisdictional boundaries. So a lot of times, even if there is public transit available, you know, it might end at the county line or the city line.
Even within those jurisdictions, there can be gaps.
Public transit simply isn't everywhere where people need to go.
Changing that would mean a significant shift in how local and state officials design their services. So what's the solution?
This is both a funding and a structural puzzle to solve.
Denise Jess is another co-chair of the Non-Driver Advisory Committee. Jess is also legally blind and a non-driver, so she's experienced many of the barriers she's trying to address.
My invitation is that the state legislature really comes to the table and works with us on this very complex transportation problem that we face in this state.
Governor Tony Evers and state legislators will have the chance to do that when work on the next state budget begins in February. Jonah Chester, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, we'll look at the quest for a new House Speaker, with the Republican majority still trying to figure out who that's going to be. Plus, we'll look ahead at some of the big issues facing Congress in 2023, with a narrow Republican majority in the House, narrow Democratic majority in the U.S. Senate. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.